All right, what is going on, everybody? Welcome back to SaberSims DFS Office Hours. It is Monday, May 2nd of 2022. Happy Monday and happy May to everybody. Hope you all had a good weekend out there. Crazy to think that it is May here already. I know, very cliche thing to say, I guess, all things considered, but it really does feel like the year is flying by. It's crazy that we are easing into the middle of spring, and summer's right around the corner here. Not that it feels that way out here in the Denver area today. Woke up to a pretty brisk 32-degree morning this morning here. Had some freezing rain overnight, so a bit of a chilly one here out by me. First of all, my name's Jordan. I'm the head coach here at SaberSim. For those of you that are tuning in for the first time here, watching this live or watching the recording back here on YouTube, this is an open Q&A style show where I answer questions from the SaberSim community that come in through Slack or through YouTube chat live on this show about SaberSim, about DFS strategy, whatever you guys want to talk about. The questions that we get drive the conversation here. So if you have questions while you're watching live, feel free to pop those into YouTube chat or in the Office Hours channel in Slack. And if you are catching this as a recording, there will be a link to join our Slack community in the description of this video on YouTube. You can join up. There'll be a notification sent in Slack every day when this show is about to go live. And if you can't catch it live for whatever reason, you could just throw your question into the Slack channel and I'll get to it on the very next show. So definitely recommend joining up in Slack already if you haven't. Not only will you get access to those the Office Hours channel, but you'll get access to the community at large, our free sports betting and prop betting picks that we post every single day in there, as well as sim alerts. When we run new sims for games, there'll be an alert in the Slack channel. So I say that every single show as a part of the introduction here, because it is worth it. Definitely join up into the Slack community if you are not already there. We do have some interesting questions here to talk about here today. The first one, we will start our day talking a little bit about overlay and chasing overlay before slates lock. Something that I think used to be a lot more of a popular and more viable strategy just when the sites were a little younger and a little less skilled at sizing their contests. And maybe when there was also more fluctuation in how many people wanted to play different slates and different sports every day. I think it was a little bit more of a easy to do strategy, but you can still chase overlay. There still is often overlay. And I think you can be very specific about the way you chase overlay if you're really paying attention to a lot of different kinds of slates and sports and things like that. So we'll talk about that a little bit. I know there are some questions about research builds in basketball, especially for the playoffs. We'll go talk about that a little bit as well. A few questions about smart randomness for the few remaining sports where we don't have our full simulations for, like USFL. We'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk about projected points and the value of projected points and basically how far you can take projected points as a metric of determining if a lineup is good in NBA. We have some questions as well about how to better identify what the higher scoring lineups will be in your pool of lineups in step three. So a pretty diverse stream here today. Should be a lot of fun. Lots to talk about. I'm excited to be here. Excited to get started here with this week. I had a pretty decent, before we move on, pretty decent weekend of DFS for me. It could have been better. I would say, more specifically, I had a pretty good weekend of DFS sweats. I had a sweat on Saturday on FanDuel for the main the early slate main GPP, so it was a little bit smaller. It's not like the 25K or the 30K ones they run on the main slates, but for the early, had a little 5K sweat going on there for a long time, actually, and then dropped. I think like the Mariners went off later that afternoon, and then had a pretty decent finish in golf yesterday as well. Could have been better. I was very close to taking down the $8 three max, and then ended up falling like, I think to like fourth or something there, which makes a pretty big difference in the payout structure, but was, leading that contest for a long time, heading it down to the finish. Aaron Wise, his Sunday surge, helped quite a bit. And then I fell off as, Kitayama and a couple of those other guys ended up having pretty decent Sunday. So not a bad Sunday of DFS. Let me know how your guys' Sunday went here in the chat. If anybody had any exciting wins or sweats or maybe just a weekend of DFS that they're ready to move on from. And let's go ahead and start answering some questions. So we are actually going to start here. I want to start with... I'm going to start with this. So this was a question from Coach B here. And it was the overlay question. So let's get into this. And this is an interesting one. So I'll read the question first. He said, do you have any best rules or guidelines for capitalizing on overlay right before lock? Last 2 weeks, I've been watching guaranteed contests 10 minutes before they go to lock. And within the last 3 minutes, hop in on some of the best options. Some of them I nailed correctly. Some of them actually filled up in the last 45 seconds. So I didn't get any benefit at all. How long do you wait before you start entering? Do you have extra lineups or your number one lineups waiting to be pressed? What percent do you look for? 70% filled, 80% filled, etc. This is a tough question. This used to be a lot easier. I will say that it used to be a lot more frequent that you would get overlay. It was, I would say, you know, you could be pretty consistent with virtually every single slate, sitting down and kind of just preparing to wait until the slates were locking and see what didn't fill. And there was typically something out there that wasn't going to fill, that you could get into. And now I think the slates realize, or the sites realize, how much money they stand to lose when these contests overlay. And they will lean on, especially like DraftKings will lean on the side of undersizing the contest and opening up a newer, smaller contest instead of getting caught out with an overlay situation. But it still does come up. I think if you are going to, so I'll say this first of all, I think overlay now for the modern DFS player, or what I typically end up doing, is it's not something that I am actively looking for on any given slate to slate basis personally, just because I don't feel like it comes up often enough. What I will do though is just be prepared for situations where it is coming up. So a good example, the golf slate, the main slate for this past week, just didn't fill. There was a ton of overlay in that morning. I didn't end up getting into as much of that as I would have liked, but just being prepared for that, knowing what overlay is, and keeping an eye out for slates that you're already going to play, and just identifying, you know, ideally, if you were talking about a percentage I've got this Roto Grinders percentage up here, right? I think if you are serious about actually getting a slate that is going to overlay, you would probably hope that the slate was, I don't know, 80% full or so before the last 10 minutes before the slate locks, right? A lot of people do this, and a lot of contests will fill at the very last second for a variety of reasons here. So I think you're probably looking for at least like 20% of the contest to be unfilled, and kind of seeking out that percentage there at the last second. But what I guess the point I'm really trying to make here is that I don't know how easy this is to do on typical main slates on a night-to-night basis. I think in general, the sites are very good at filling up their contests, especially their big marquee contests, right? DraftKings is good enough to know how big the $15 relay throw should be now at this point for a Monday night main slate of baseball in May, right? That they're unlikely to undersize it enough that it overlays. Now, there is an exception to this. I think there's two exceptions where you can still find some overlay. And really, it is in the alternative slates and alternative styles of slates, right? So if you go hunting in things like the night slate, right, or different showdown contests, I think it is more likely that you are going to see situations where even a more marquee contest, like the $10 for the night slate or something like that, or the main GPP or something like that, does end up overlaying. These contests are just smaller. I think DraftKings and even FanDuel, you know, I don't want to say they care less about them, but there are probably less resources invested in perfectly sizing these contests. And I think you can find a little bit more of an opportunity to squeeze into these and get into contests here that don't end up filling right before lock. I would still say you're probably hoping to avoid a situation where that contest does end up just filling right before lock. You're probably still hoping that that contest is 20 to 25% empty in the final 10 minutes for that to maintain. Guy Will Gamble said, aren't you looking for even lower percentage to account for rake possibly? Yeah, so I mean, these are going to be raked at about 15%. So you have overlay, true overlay, until the contest is 85% full. And then after that, then everything is reduced rake. So if the contest fills to 95%, then technically DraftKings is paying 5% of the 16% of the rake. So and this is just anecdotal, but I would say in general, you know, if the contest is only 75% full 10 minutes before lock, I think it's unlikely that it's going to get all the way there before lock. That's just in my experience. I think that's a pretty good baseline. But anyway, these smaller slates, these showdowns, and other smaller size classic slates, I think you can do a little bit better. And probably the best opportunity to find find overlay now at this point where DFS is in guaranteed satellites. So there's only so many of these, but from what I've noticed, DraftKings will just continue to open up new versions of these contests indefinitely. They will, for example, you know, if they're running these $1 satellites for the $13 live final qualifier, right? One out of 20 people, right? This contest will just continue to get reopened as it gets filled. It will fill to 20 and then it will get reopened. And that is even true, at least as far as I can tell in my experience, that will continue to be true forever, all the way to lock, even into the final 5 or 10 minutes of lock. So I think probably your best use of overlay hunting on a nightly basis, on a slate-to-slate nightly basis, is going to be in the satellites. And to keep an eye out for when guaranteed contests open in the last like 5 or 10 minutes before lock that have no hope of being filled in that amount of time. Other people do this, and a contest of 20 people, even a single entry, doesn't take too many people looking at this to fill a lot of these spots at the last second. But it's typically pretty easy, to get these at least rake free and sometimes a little bit overlaid. And what's nice about that is I think one of the biggest reasons to avoid satellites in general, one of the biggest arguments against satellites, is you get raked twice. You get raked on the satellite contest, and you get raked when you play the event that you won the ticket for. If you can get into one of these that is even just rake-free, then you suddenly are paying... You're essentially playing probably what is... You're playing for an opportunity to win a ticket to a contest that you otherwise would not have been able to play and only getting raked the one time on it. I think this can be a really good way to do it. And then otherwise, apart from that, basically looking out for slates where the sites have just made a issue across the board, like we had for golf last week, where, you know, I think it's generally fair to say that on a main slate for a primary sport, for a popular sport, it's just unlikely now at this point that DraftKings is just going to oopsie the main GPP and make it way too big when they shouldn't have. But you will see situations where maybe there was something else going on, or they oversized the contest or something. Like the golf example is a perfect example of last week, where virtually every contest overlaid in golf because that the Mexico Open was just an event that, you know, it was a weak field. I don't think it was a very exciting event to build DFS lineups for. And people didn't really play it, right? So every contest overlaid. So looking out for situations like that and hunting these satellites for the satellites, again, specifically what I'm saying is like, look, wait for that contest to get opened at the last second, right? Because they will. As far as I can tell, this is a totally automated process. So, you know, let's say it was 10 minutes before lock right now or something like that. Like eyeballing something like this, like this $50 contest that has 4 entries left to fill it. Contests will just be filling, right? As lock approaches, if this fills and a new one opens and it's 1 out of 22 or 0 out of 22, 5 minutes before lock, that's what you're going for. And I've had decent success with that. I personally just don't have the time as much that I used to hawk this like I used to in the past, but I think this can be a pretty viable strategy on these satellites in particular. So anyway, don't want to beat a dead horse. I think I've covered that enough. Coach B, let me know if that helps. Curious to hear if you have any other thoughts on this as well, if you've had any success with some different strategies. I think you could have almost built an entire a profitable DFS strategy, you know, even 3 or 4 years ago, really aggressively hunting overlay. But the sites have gotten a lot better with handling that for their big contests where most of that money is anyway. I guess to that point, maybe the last thing I will note is that on smaller sized sites, they are not yet as skilled at doing this, and they're going to have more variance in how many people are playing that night. So Yahoo is getting big enough here that I think they're getting pretty good, and they size their contests conservatively, but I think Yahoo is pretty interesting. I know Superdraft I know SaberSim at the moment does not have SuperDraft support yet. That's something that's kind of been on our roadmap for some time. Keeps getting kind of pushed back with other priorities for us. But I know SuperDraft does overlay fairly often. I think they're a little bit more aggressive with their contest sizing. I think they, you know, as a smaller site, they can use overlay as a bit of a loss leader or user acquisition as well. So playing on smaller sites as well can be an opportunity to find some overlay there as well. Similar to, you know, kind of how it was for the DraftKings and FanDuels of the world a few years ago. But anyway, what I was saying is that, you know, there was a time where this was almost a viable strategy on its own. You did not even need to know DFS as well. I mean, it was a different game 3 years ago, period. But it was, you know, if you think about the difference between 0% rake and 16% rake, if you can just find contests often enough that had no rake, your edge was much easier to secure. But things have changed a little bit there. I think it is an edge that has somewhat dried up. Still an opportunity on maybe some of these satellites or smaller slates. But anyway, let's move forward. We got a lot to talk about today. Wanted to start there because I don't think I've really talked too much in detail about overlay above and beyond just saying, yes, it's good and look for it. So appreciate that question. It's a good question. I guess the last thing I'll note on this, since I just noticed this here, is that coach from on the practical side, he said, do you have your extra lineups or your number one lineups waiting to be pressed? So like, what are you actually going to enter? For me, what I have done in the past, so typically for me, I am already playing other lineups on that slate. Honestly, what I actually end up doing is, because of how easy it is to use the entry editor, typically what I will do is I will kind of hawk the lobby for about 2 minutes before lock and then decide when I'm going to enter. And then I will get entered in it as quickly as possible. I will enter those contests and then I will actually go back to SaberSim, pull down a fresh entry file and basically have a set of lineups. Some, you know, I don't know, maybe 20, however many lineups I made, 20 unique satellite lineups that I made, and just quickly enter them in. At that point, you know, you don't have the time to decide what lineups are going into what. Your edge in that particular case is mostly in the overlay itself. So I basically just have lineups built on SaberSim that I'm prepared to enter into those satellites. And within the last couple minutes, I will enter, download a fresh entries file, and get that all taken care of at the very last second. That's typically how I've gone about doing it. I think you could probably just do this pretty easily just on the site as well. So, but good questions, good stuff. Let's move on here for now. I'm going to back us up a little bit here and answer some of these questions that came in over the weekend here. Okay, so this first one was from Mills about smart randomness. He said, can you explain how smart randomness affects the creation of USFL lineups if you don't run USFL sims and the system only knows the one input, mean projection? I can't imagine how it treats two players with the same inputs any differently. True range of outcomes makes it sound like the system would treat Tyfreek and Deontay differently if they both have the same projections, but I'm assuming it doesn't. So for the sports where we don't have simulations, which are not very many of these now at this point, and will continue to be less and less, for these sports, the sim variance slider becomes smart randomness instead. This tooltip is copied directly from SimVariance. This isn't very descriptive of what randomness actually does. Smart randomness, what this does is it will assume that every player has a normal distribution. It will take the mean as that. It will take the uploaded custom projection as that player's mean. And what you are essentially controlling, this is not mathematically exactly what's happening here, but this slider is essentially controlling the standard deviation. So you are getting a wider range of a normally distributed outcome as your smart randomness goes up. At zero, you would just be using the average projection. So no, for USFL, smart randomness is not going to understand the difference between a deep threat receiver who has a very boom or bust type outcome versus a possession-based receiver whose outcomes are typically concentrated around his mean, right? We do understand that for NFL, where we have simulations and we get the difference between, Deontay Johnson and Tyreek Hill or something, for example. If they had the same projection, we get that they have different ranges of outcomes. We pull from those outcomes when we use the sims. But for any sport like USFL, where we don't have those simulations, it is just going to assume a normal distribution. So I know that is not necessarily ideal, which is why it is basically our highest priority project at any point on the model side is to continue getting new models and new simulations out. That's why getting NASCAR and MMA and Formula One and these different sports out has been a high priority for us so far this year. We are not like everybody else out there, encouraged by the USFL trends so far this season. I know it has been a bit of a mess with both the reporting. I haven't played any USFL DFS. I don't know how anybody would reliably get an edge at this point with just how bad the reporting has been of who he's even going to play. Also, not very encouraging signs with the contest sizing. So it's something we are going to continue working. Well, I will say it's something we're going to continue watching. I don't think it is on our radar for this season, really, even to build out USFL sims. We are, I would say, more concerned with the upcoming college football season, getting simulations for college football, and then college basketball as well. Tennis, soccer, I think all have priority over USFL for simulations for us at the moment. But anyway, to answer the original question again here, you are essentially assuming a normal distribution for these players when you upload custom projections here, and your smart randomness slider controls more or less the standard deviation of those players. So. Okay, let's jump to a question. This is from Tone 930 about my trusty research builds for NBA. It's a good question. And he said, Jordan, I have a question about research builds in NBA. To give you context as to where I am going with the question, I think you have previously said that the 0-0-10 builds, so that's zero correlation, zero ownership fade, 10 sim variance sliders, right? That build is not effective because there is not as much variance in NBA. I have developed a process I feel good about for MLB in which I use the exposures from a 0-0-10 build in conjunction with a formula I've developed to quantify leverage. I'd like to try this process out during the NBA playoffs since playoff DFS is not as hectic as regular season. And I've automated most of my process through Excel to the point where it takes me only minutes to execute, so I feel good about the time factor. Being that I am using the research build exposures and weighing it against my leverage calculation, do you recommend using the added variance of the 0-0-10 build to cover as many outcomes as possible, or do you think that using the default sim variance for contest slate size like a 0-0 default sim variance? Very good question. Very detailed question. And I know Tone and I have gone back and forth before here about research builds. And I can tell, I think the last time I remember you asking a question, I think I had mentioned something about how long it would take to do it. So I love that you've crossed that one off here already by mentioning that you've automated most of this. I will say I would use 0-0-10. And I think this is actually a great idea. I've been doing something similar. And I've talked about that a little bit here on stream as we've entered the playoffs. That, you know, all regular season, every single time almost anybody asks me about my NBA DFS process, I would say that I basically do an NBA process that is centered around facilitating late swap as effectively as possible. And that is the biggest edge I feel like there is in regular season NBA. Well, in postseason NBA, not only because there are just less games on the slate, but also because every team has a big incentive to win every game, that late swap edge dries up a little bit. I don't think it's as there. It's not as reliable. So I've been doing actually a very similar thing. I have returned to running my research builds and calculating how likely players are to show up in the optimal lineup and comparing that to ownership projections and making some exploitative ownership-based decisions from there. So I would use 0-0-10. I don't think there's going to be a significant difference. You know, depending on what contest you're building for, the sim variance is going to be so high by default anyway. I always just end up using 0, 0, 10 for the most part, just because that is a single simulation optimal at that point. I don't like the idea when you're trying to determine how likely a player is to show up in the winning lineup. I don't like pulling the sim variance down because I think you start to get too close to average projections. I like having that single game simulation. The fact that there's only two games on the slate and the default value for sim variance is very close to 10 or 10 for most of these contests anyway, just makes that all the better. But I would always do these at 0, 0, 10 anyway, just so you get that single simulation value in there. But I think this is a great approach. I think this is a good idea for NBA. DFS. I will say quickly here, I do want to just clarify, you know, whenever we talk about these builds, I think they can be a bit confusing to newer users to SaberSim. So I do want to kind of just quickly, for those of you watching that maybe are a little bit lost on what we're talking about here, one thing that is very core to my strategy in virtually every sport is I will run builds that look something like this. Right, my settings will essentially look like this. So I will have correlation and ownership fade off, sim variance at 10. I will turn min salary to 0, and I will build 1,500 lineups. What this does is this essentially builds 1,500 optimal lineups for a given set of sims of that slate. Right, it takes a single game simulation for each game on the slate. In this case, there's only two games, and builds the optimal lineup for that set of two games. You can use the exposures that you get in step three here as a way to approximate the percent chance of a player showing up in the optimal lineup. Basically, if you have ever used a boom or bust tool or a smash percentage, right? I know some of our competitors have those out there. Boom and bust tools, smash percentages, basically they will quantify the percent chance that a player is in the winning lineup and compare that to ownership. This is just that. But we do it, you do it for yourself, basically. You have control over that build rather than it being just kind of a number handed to you. That is essentially what this is. And I think at times I have explained this in a more confusing way on this stream. But I think that is essentially what this does. So anyway. All this to say, Tone, I think your idea is great. I would use 0, 0, 10. I think it's a good idea, especially in postseason when there's less of a late swap edge. Ownership becomes more important anyway because the slates are, there's less games on the slate, and I like it. So let me know if that helps. But let's keep it rolling. Okay. A few questions from top here. Let's see here. Okay. So this question here, I've been making some noise with these two gamers, but I can't get over the hump. I do my research builds, et cetera. Is there anything more I can do for an edge? Okay. So it looks like there's three questions here. So that's question one. I don't know what making some noise looks like, nor do I know exactly what getting over the hump looks like. I will say, you know, I mean, based on what I'm kind of reading here, if you're doing generally pretty well, like if you're putting what this does come up sometimes where I get a question from somebody that, you know, doing pretty well, putting more than their fair share of lineups in the top 1%, but how do you get to that final bink, right? How do you take something down? A lot of that is actually just going to be variance. Like if you are finding that you are in generally doing pretty well, that your top 1% equity looks pretty good, you're maybe generally, you know, break even or slightly profitable, and you're asking what is the next step to being more successful, it is probably patience, most likely, and waiting until you have that higher variance. You basically run good, right? But that's only if you can kind of demonstrate that your process is working otherwise, right? I wouldn't say just wait it out if you told me you had a 0.8% of your lineups were in the top 1% of your contest, right? At that point, you're probably just losing money. But I would say, you know, probably, you know, sign up for something like Roto Tracker and check on your top 1% equity and see if you're doing well. And if you are doing well in terms of outpacing your top 1% equity, if you are, you know, I would say to probably be patient. So, But for two gamers in particular, since you mentioned it, I think no matter how you do this, whether you're doing this like more intuitively or, you know, even when I do my research builds and try to leverage directly against ownership, what I have found is generally the best strategy for these two game. And I didn't play this two gamer today, but what is often the best strategy I've noticed is to just be very over on whatever like the least owned stack is, like almost to just take the stack ownership of each individual team and flip it on its head in terms of your exposures. That's like what I have found. So if, you know, if 10% of the field is going to have royal stacks for this slate, I don't know what it actually worked out as. Stack up the royals, right? The ownership gets way out of control for these two game slates. And if you do that and then also build lineups that are generally pretty correlated, I think you'll eventually just find that you're successful on these smaller slates. So, and then second question, getting into single game. I know there is no need to touch the settings, but yesterday when I ran a 20 max, it was only Towns and Curry at MVP. Even if those two have the best chance of MVP, why not more diversity there without having to increase my uniques? So since you said MVP, I think you were probably talking about FanDuel. And FanDuel is a little bit unique in that because you do not have to pay more to roster a player at a multiplier position. So in other words, if Ja Morant is basically 15-5 to use at the utility, the pro, the star, the MVP, basically what happens is as you move up into bigger and bigger multipliers, the projection disparity between different players gets bigger and bigger, right? So the practical impact of this is, and I just realized Towns and Curry, this maybe this was for like 2 days ago or something. I don't know. Maybe you were talking about Morant and Curry. I get probably Morant and Curry, I think is probably what you were saying. But anyway, the difference in projection, so we can see, right? So Curry is 5 points at the utility spot, the raw projections. He has 5 points of a higher projection than the next best player, which was Draymond. And Morant has 7 points higher than the next best player, which was Draymond. Well, at MVP, right? Because the multiplier is now applied, that is a 10-point difference and a 13-point difference with no change in salary. So what that is ultimately going to mean is that SaberSim, and I would say most optimizers, and actually not even, I don't even want to just say optimizers, basically almost any tool you use is going to overwhelmingly tell you that the optimal strategy is to use the better projected players at those multiplier positions, because that projection difference is multiplied without a additional increase in salary. What DraftKings does that is different is you pay more to roster a player at a captain spot. So it's not as easy as play the best projected players at the captain every time, because you also have to pay more to get them there, right? So in FanDuel, I think basically, you know, you're going to see this most of the time. Now, the way that they kind of even that out, at least for the NBA product, is you have three multiplier positions, right? So there is some disparity in, you know, how you use different players in the pro, the star, or the MVP. But consistently, SaberSim is going to tell you that the optimal strategy for almost every NBA single game contest you play is to use the best projected players at the MVP slot. And I agree with that because this number is not changing, right? So, and remember too, right? This isn't, you know, this isn't something. Well, actually, this is kind of interesting here. Actually, you know what? I'll say this. I'll say you can kind of use this as a little bit of a research build, right? So if you want to expand this up, look at your entire lineup of 1500 and then look and see, right? There is still a lot of diversity in your actual build here. When it comes down to the 20 lineups that you might be playing, it's going to say, yeah, play the Curry and Morant lineups. But you have a lot more diversity in this pool of 1500 lineups, right? So, you know, Draymond has a 10% chance to be the optimal MVP. Bane has a 9%. Clay, right? I don't know who, was it Jordan Poole, right, who ended up being the optimal MVP? I assume it might have been. I'm not totally sure, but 3% chance, right? There are lineups that have these guys. So you should have, if you build a big pool of 1500 lineups, you should have enough diversity to do some different things here if you even wanted to just fade both of these guys, right? But by default, SaberSim is going to tell you what is optimal is almost always to play these guys in those spots. So, and then anyway, the last question here, MLB, 20 Max has been doing well for me. I've missed a few videos, but I just wanted to know the best approach to MLB 20 Max. My overall baseball approach does not change dramatically based on the size of the contest or the entry limit of the contest I'm playing once I'm multi-entering, right? I will, process-wise, do a little bit of different things if I'm going to play just a single lineup or a three entry max. But once I'm playing a 20 lineups or more, I do my typical research build-based process, figuring out where I'm going to leverage against the field or where I'm going to exploit ownership. And otherwise, there was another question I think another user had asked about 20 maxes in the MLB channel earlier today as well. I don't have a particularly 20 max focused process that is differentiated compared to my other processes, my other multi-entry processes. The main thing that I think about when I'm playing 20 max is, you know, that you do have less lineups to work with than if you're playing 150, right? Where if you're playing 150, 10% exposure to a player actually has some meaning. That's 15 lineups, right? You can do things with 15 lineups. 10% exposure in a 20 max is two lineups, and what you can accomplish with two lineups in terms of covering different outcomes is a lot more limited. That's not to say that I'm unwilling to have a player that's only in one or two of my lineups here in a 20 max, but I guess what I am saying is that rather than trying to find every exploitable edge in a 20 max and say, these are all of the different stacks that I think are underowned, I'm going to try to get to exposure to all of them. I am more likely to say these are maybe the three or four stacks where I think the field is approaching really incorrectly, and let me get some more significant exposure to these teams, right? In 150 lineups, it is very likely that I will have a stack of almost every team. In 20, that is not going to happen. So that's probably the biggest difference, the biggest material difference for me is how much exposure I get to some of those guys. So same thing with pitchers. I will definitely have 20 max. It's definitely likely that I could have 20 lineups that have all at least one pitcher in it. It's very unlikely that I would ever have 150 lineups with one pitcher. So that's probably the biggest difference for me, is that I'm willing to condense a little bit more on a 20 max set. So, but good questions. Let me know if that helps. Happy to talk a little bit more about that. Okay, let's from here jump over. There were a few questions that had gotten emailed in today. So let's go talk about some of these here. Okay, this one's from Josh. And he said, I was doing some back testing on the 428 late slate and had some questions. I ended up doing 25 lineups with a 100 lineup pool. When I sorted by actual score, I was able to get a score towards the top of my contest in my 25. I tried analyzing the ownership, saber score, projected score, and percentile and couldn't find anything to correlate being able to pluck that particular lineup out from the pool and get it into my lineups. When I did my original build, that lineup wasn't in my 25, but it wasn't the total pool of 100, and only when I sorted by actual score. Sorting by anything else took it out of my 25. Is there some way to do this properly that I'm missing or some kind of best practice? Thanks for any tips. Good question. And a common question, right? I had this excellent winning lineup in my pool. How do I get it into my lineups, right? The simple and unsatisfying answer here is that that's very hard to do. If we consistently and reliably and recreatably, right? If we knew what the highest actual scoring lineups were going to be, it would be far, far easier to identify what were the highest actual scoring lineups out of a pool. Saber score is essentially an attempt to quantify this in a way that is recreatable and reproducible, but only over the long term, right? You're never going to be able to just build lineups. And I wish saber score would take a pool of 1500 lineups and give you the best actual scoring 20 every single time. It won't. The goal of it is to give you the best, highest expected value lineups over the long term, so that if you were to replay the slate out over and over again, that those would be the most profitable lineups. Even if saber score was perfect, there would still be variance there where you wouldn't actually get the highest actual scoring lineups every single time. And saber score is not perfect. It is our best way of approximating expected value. So I would actually argue instead here, rather than I think if you repeatedly backtest a single slate and you are trying to figure out how to optimize to get the highest actual scoring lineup out of your 100 and into your top 20, you are ultimately, even if you figure out some way to do that, all you are going to do is have figured out some order of button presses that just happen to do that exact thing for that slate. I don't think you're going to leave with a repeatable process that works for you in the future, that actually does anything better than what SaberScore does for you in the future. Rather than trying to figure out above and beyond SaberScore how to get the best lineups out of your pool and into your set, I would instead try to see if from a contest selection standpoint, you can get more lineups in play, right? Whenever this question comes in, I always think that this is actually a contest selection question in disguise, right? That this is not actually about how do I get my best 25 out of my 100, but rather how can I start playing 100, right? And maybe that's not an option for you. If you are playing, you know, maybe you're playing just $10 or so a night, and you're playing the quarter jukebox, and you're playing, maybe you're playing a handful of different contests, and you're already doing this, and that's fine. But I would check and see, you know, are there contests that fit SaberSim's contest selection recommendations? Which, if you are not sure what those are, I have a video up on our YouTube channel called "The Fastest Way." Or wait, now I forget. So many different names of everything on our YouTube channel. This video breaks down. There it is. 4 simple rules to build your MLB DFS bankroll. This video breaks down our contest selection recommendations. But I would think about. I would ask yourself: is there a way that I can be getting more lineups in play on a given slate, if possible? Right? Because in reality, if you have the top scoring, or not even the top scoring, but if you have a GPP winning contest in your 100 anyway, there are literally trillions of lineups that you can build for a typical MLB main slate. So if you are building 100 and one of those lineups has having a top 1% outcome, that's great. That says a lot about your process anyway. And I don't think worrying about how to get that in your top 25 is as much of a good use of time. I would worry more about how you can get more lineups in play, personally. The last note I will make on this, because I think it is worth mentioning, is I would actually build more lineups. I would try to have a pool size that is at least 10 times bigger than the number of lineups you actually need. So if you're building 25 lineups with the intention of playing 25 lineups, I would build at least 250. And what that does is that will make SaberScore better, right? That will increase the value of our ability. If you have a bigger pool from which to work with, we will be better able to determine what the best lineups of that pool are. Right? Because there is a lower floor of those lineups. There's a bigger discrepancy between the best lineup and then the worst lineup. It is easier for our SaberScore calculations to determine what the best lineups are. And not even determine what the best lineups are, but giving the builder more lineups to build will increase how good the best lineup can be. So I would say, and this is a side note, but I would say if you're going to build a 25 lineups, build with a 250 lineup pool at least. And I think by default, you know, if you come in here and say 20, by default pool size is going to be 500. So even 500 is great, right? If you're using 100, you must be coming in here and turning that down. I would probably just stop doing that. But to summarize and answer the specific question at hand here, I would say really a few things. One, SaberScore is our attempt to quantify what the best lineups are. So that some of this is already happening for you. Optimizing and figuring out for one particular slate how to get that highest actual scoring lineup in your top 25 is literally only going to be that. I don't think you will leave that with a repeatable process that you can use in the future. And instead of even trying to do that, focus on getting more lineups in play so that you don't even have to worry about it because you played 100 lineups, right? And remember that having a top scoring lineup in your top 100 period is just a very good thing, even if on that particular slate you didn't get so lucky to have it in your top 25. So Josh, let me know if that was helpful. I know we'll get you a recording to this video here sent to you back via email. So if you have any follow-up, any other questions for me, feel free to fire away at me here. Let me go ahead and hit this one other question. I had one other question that came in through our email. We'll hit this, and then I see a couple questions that are in YouTube chat, so we'll get to those as well. All right, this is from Scott. And Scott says, good morning. This is an NBA question. My process has evolved into crunching 400 to 500 lineups with a target projection, 370, for example, then take all the lineups that were 370 and better and picking the highest projected ones from that list. What would be a good way to refine this process as far as making projections more accurate? I hope that makes sense. Thank you, and may the basketball gods be with you. Cool. Interesting question here. So I'll say this. So basically, it sounds like what you're doing is essentially optimizing for an average projection, right? Reading this back, right? If you're building a bunch of lineups, eliminating lineups below a certain projection threshold, and then sorting the highest projected lineups from there. I will say, okay. So, I mean, I have a couple thoughts on this. Overall, I think, optimizing for the highest average projected lineups possible is better than nothing, right? Is better than kind of picking names. But there are big issues with optimizing purely for average projection. Two big ones. There are really three issues, or at least three issues with optimizing for average projection. And they are essentially our sliders, that we've added to the SaberSim builder to do things different than that, right? All typical traditional optimizers basically just do this. They take an average projection and they optimize the best lineups that maximize that number. And what SaberSim does that is different is basically to fix the problems with that method. So the problems with optimizing for average projection are average projections don't account for correlations, which in a sport like basketball, especially on these two or three game slates, doesn't really matter that much. But an average projection does not account for the fact that two players may have correlated outcomes together. They may not be independent. Very important for these two game NBA slates that average projections do not account for is ownership, right? A fantasy point is not an equal value. It is not an absolute value. Players with lower overall ownership have higher relative value to their fantasy points scored because they are fantasy points that are not shared with the other lineups in the contest you are playing, right? In DFS, we are not trying to just build the highest optimal scoring lineup possible. We are trying to beat the other lineups in the contest. So, you know, a good example is a coin flip, right? Let's say you're playing a DFS contest where all you're doing you're playing with a coin flip, right? Where you're playing a one player lineup where you get to pick heads or tails, right? Heads or tails essentially have the same average projection, right? They 50% chance of winning. You're playing against nine other people. Now, let's say you know that all nine other people are going to pick tails, right? Now, if you were purely optimizing for average projection, right, you would get 50% of it, and you were multi-entering this, even though it doesn't make sense. 50% of your lineups would have tails, 50% would have heads. But if you incorporate ownership in there, it's going to tell you that it always makes more sense to play heads, because if it is heads, then you win. And if it's tails, you win, but you split with nine other people, and everybody just gets their dollar back, right? So the expected value is better to play. So it's a very quick way to prove that ownership matters in fantasy, in DFS, right? And then finally, variance, right? Players optimizing for average projections really only takes you so far because players don't score just their average projections every single time. So even if you have a player, you know, if you have a player that is supposed to score 50 points and another player that's going to score 49, well, you don't just want 100% exposure necessarily to the player that is going to score 50 points, because those players have different outcomes, right? That's variance. So all of this is to say is that I think, optimizing for average projection and just playing the highest average projected lineups can take you to a certain point, but it will miss certain things like correlation and ownership fade and variance. The one other thing I will mention here is that, having a target score like 370, just as the example you gave here, I think that is also a decent step to quantifying upside, right? To saying, I can't win with 320. I need 370 to beat this contest. The problem with those target scores is that they don't really, really well take into account slate context. That's like the hardest thing I say frequently on this show, contest context. And what I mean is that, yes, if the cash lineups, if the average projected lineups are projected for 300, 350 or 370 might be what it takes to win a big GPP. But what if you were playing a single entry 500 person contest, right? You probably need less points. And if you're playing a slate where pricing is really efficient, right, then it's going to be harder to build lineups that have a very high scoring outcome, because you have to pay a lot for each fantasy point you get in terms of the salary of the players that you're rostering. So all of this to say, honestly, before I would move to thinking about how am I going to improve the projections, I would start with making sure that you have a good understanding of kind of these other things that start to come into play that are above and beyond projections, right? What does correlation look like in the sport I'm playing? What does the ownership look like in the sport I'm playing? What does the variance look like in the sport I'm playing? How does that change on a per contest basis? Am I using taking into account these factors to the right amount for the different contests I'm playing, right? This will be automated for you using SaberSim, right? So if you are, if you're building for a 20 max 10 to 50K on FanDuel, right? This will, for tonight's NBA slate, for example, this is kind of will already be captured in here. And you will see that the top lineups you are given here on step three are not always just going to be the highest projected lineups because of these factors of variance and ownership. So I would start there. And make sure that makes sense, and ask any questions that you have if it doesn't. Because I think from there, asking yourself, okay, how can I make the projections more accurate is a path that's probably worth going down, but it's not just so that you can make a lineup with a higher overall projection, right? Like the point, the point of knowing that, maybe the point of dialing in the projections and making the average projection sharper is not to make a higher average projected lineup for GPPs. It would be if you were playing cash games, right? But there's kind of a more complicated thing that's going on there for GPPs. So I'd start there. I will say, if you want to go down the path of trying to dial in projections a little bit more, especially for NBA playoffs, I would start with the minutes projections. Rotations are going to continue to change and dialed in and tighten up a little bit throughout the playoffs. I think, and especially, now that we are kicking off new series, right? These coaches are going to strategize against these new opponents differently than they have been throughout the season. Game ones of series can be kind of tough, but one thing that I would do, or one thing that I think can be a way to add value if you want to take a projection-based approach to this, is after game one, when we start playing game two of these series, use like popcorn machine or something like that, and study the rotations that the teams used in game one, and combine that with some understanding of the game script, right? It will be important to know if a player got hurt or in foul trouble or anything like that. And look how many minutes players got, and look when they came in the game and things like that, and how teams matched up together. And then when you are going to build your lineup, see what the minutes projections that we have on SaberSim look like, right? And ask yourself if that makes sense and that adds up, right? I would say in general, you can probably still add a lot of value by looking at minutes projections on teams that are injured and things like that during the regular season. But in the playoffs, I think it can be especially a good way to add value for a few reasons. One, you are going to get less of an edge in other ways, like late swap. Two, there are less games on the slate so that it's easier to spend time looking at minutes projections for the available players that you have. And three, rotations are not as, I would say they're not as predictable on a game-to-game basis in the NBA playoffs. So there's value in spending time to dial them in. I would still, Scott, say first, think about how ownership and variance and correlation is being incorporated into your process first, in a way that, you know, is contest specific before making the jump to, I want to start tweaking projections. So let me know if that helps. Happy to spend a little bit more time on that. If you still have questions there, we will of course get you a recording to this video sent to you via email. Let's go ahead and jump over to YouTube chat here and make sure I've covered all the questions here. I know I saw a couple come in there. Patrick had said, how do we approach the odd entry limit contest, like a 5 max or a 36 max, for example? Which entry limit do we use? Honestly, I think the easiest thing to do is to just pick whatever's closest, right? Like for 25 maxes, I know FanDuel has 25 maxes, even 36 max will almost certainly be fine using the 20 max. For a 5 max, I think that bears enough resemblance to a 3 max. I would say if you've got something that's like dead in the middle, right? Maybe like a 75 max or a 100 max or something, then maybe you could compare the 20 max and the 150s and use something kind of in the middle, but they're going to be so similar to each other that most of the time it won't matter. Maybe a 10 max, you could do like the 3 max and the 20 and kind of pick something in between. Using manual mode, I should clarify, when you first pull up the sliders, right, you'll have to turn manual mode on to see the sliders. Right. Otherwise, you'll just see the dropdowns. But I think you'll be perfectly fine just picking something in the middle and rocking with that. So Jacob said, if Toronto is the top stack, 12% owned, play 12% neutral EV. If 12% top stack, 7% own, play at least 12% because it's plus EV. 12% top stack, 18% ownership, play no more than 12% because it's minus EV. Yeah, that is probably pretty generally true. That like bears resemblance to kind of how I think about my research builds, getting over or under the field on, you know, the different teams and players that you, getting over the field on the players that the field is going to be suboptimally under on and vice versa. Yeah, I think that makes sense. So the main thing to remember here is that, or not even remember, but you know, something to consider here is that the more lineups you are playing, the more specific and granular you can be on. There's actually two things I want to say to this. The more lineups you are playing, the more granular you can get, right? So like, this is kind of what I was saying later. Maybe your process leads you to saying that I'm going to play 20% of my lineups with Toronto stacks because the field only has 6% of them and they have a 12% chance to be the optimal lineup, right? Well, that's great. And if you're playing 150, that's, you know, that means something. If you're playing, 20 lineups, what 20% exposure to a stack looks like is a lot lower, right? And maybe this still makes sense to do, but maybe it makes more sense to, you know, skip these stacks and stack up a team that you can get more exposure to and have 10 opportunities to win if that team goes off. And that is the biggest leverage opportunity on the slate, right? Same thing, you know, as it goes from there. If you only have three lineups, maybe you should just stack one team. Find the one team that is the most suboptimally owned, or pick the one team that has the highest percent chance to be the top overall scoring stack that is under-owned. Right? Because I think one other thing that you'll find is like, often if you are calculating leverage in a very mathematical way, right, you are going to find that the best positive leverage stack is probably one of the stacks that has the lowest absolute probability of being the highest scoring stack, right? You will find there will be some team, right? Like let's pull up baseball slate, right? So maybe who has the lowest implied team total on the slate? So maybe the highest overall leverage stack on the slate is Arizona, but they're also the lowest overall probability team of being the highest percent, of being the best stack, right? So you have some decisions to make. Maybe you are better off instead playing the Twins or Seattle that have lower app leverage, but have a higher percent chance of being the absolute lineup or the highest scoring lineup, right? In like, if you're playing three lineups or even 20 or something like that. So that's one thing to consider. The other thing to consider too, is, and I think this is an important point to make, is that exposures. So when we think about lineups, lineups have expected value, right? Exposures are just descriptive of your risk you are taking on to certain assets in this portfolio of lineups, right? But it is not actually really true. Like, if we're getting really into the weeds here, it is not necessarily just true that if you have 20% exposure to Toronto, that theoretically has a positive expected value. Or, okay, let me start over. I'm sorry. So let's say Toronto has a 12% chance to be the highest scoring stack, and they're going to be in 6% of the lineups by the field, and you're going to put them in 20% of your lineups, right? On that fact alone, it is not necessarily true that that lineup portfolio is just positive EV, right? EV is something that happens on a lineup basis, right? You still need to build good lineups, right? You could build 20 lineups with Toronto stacks that, you know, have a bunch of other players. An obvious example is if you fill those lineups with players that aren't even playing, right? Those lineups aren't just good because you're over the field on Toronto, right? Well, we can follow that logic to say something like, you know, if you fill those Toronto stacks with other players that are negatively leveraged, maybe that lineup now no longer is positive EV. So it is not necessarily true that a portfolio of lineups is positive EV just because your exposure is over the field on players that you think the field has suboptimal ownership. So, Jacob, okay, so another interesting point here. From an EV perspective, why would you ever want to have more of our portfolio allocation be more than the efficient ownership of the stack? Say Toronto is the 12% top stack. Having more than 12% is suboptimal. Yeah, this gets into a pretty interesting like game theory argument of exploitation versus playing balanced. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, to be honest. Like, if you want to play perfectly balanced and basically roster every single player and every single stack at the rate at which they are the optimal stack, you make yourself unexploitable at that point. That is the definition of what a game theory optimal or a balanced strategy is in games of chance, whether we're talking about DFS or poker or anything else, right? That is, you cannot be exploited. So having more than 12% is suboptimal. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. It allows you to be exploited at that point, right? By the field. Now you can expand on your expected value of a given lineup if you know what the field is going to do, right? If you play in a way that particularly exploits an edge, you can increase your EV of a given lineup, but only if you know what the field is going to do, right? And the less you know about what the field is going to do, the more you open yourself up to actually reducing your expected value. So some of this comes down to a little bit of a personal play style thing. Like, do you want to take the additional chance to increase your expected value by playing in a way that exploits ownership? All right. That's kind of the question here. So I would say it's kind of a 50-50 way that I play most of the time. So I take into account ownership, right? That's the goal of a research build. That's what I'm attempting to try to do, is figure out what the field's going to do, figure out why it's inefficient, and specifically exploit that. But I also play in a very diversified way. So I am trying to also spread out very much, spread out a lot, right? If you were playing in a true balanced game theory optimal way, you would be extremely spread out in your exposures for a sport like basketball. So this is a bit of a rabbit hole here on this particular question. So I'm going to move on and hit some of these other questions here that are in Slack, or not Slack, I'm sorry, in YouTube chat here. And move on. But I'd be happy to kind of go back and forth and talk about this a little bit more. This is a trendy conversation in the DFS content world right now. Basically, the argument for and against balanced strategies versus exploitative strategies. I know Jordan Cooper's talked about this on his podcast recently. Neil Orfield has talked about this on his podcast recently. It's been a popular question going on. I think, last thing I'll say on this, I think the trendy direction, the way that the field is moving, or the at least the like high stakes sharper field is moving here, is more in the direction of playing in a very balanced strategy and focusing less on trying to exploit ownership in particular. And I think that's interesting. I think the best argument in general of playing a more balanced strategy overall, and this is something that I've mentioned on this stream before and talked about this a lot, is that the more exploitable a field the field is going to get, right, the harder it is to predict exactly how they are going to be exploitable. In other words, you have to assume some amount of rationality to project ownership. You have to assume that the field is going to do X because of Y. They're going to follow from logical premises, and then at that point you can predict them, right? Well, the more rational they are, the more predictable they are, but also the less likely they are to then make mistakes. So you are relying on it's a paradox almost, right? You need the field to act irrationally to have an exploitable ownership edge, but the more irrationally they act, the less predictable they are, and the less you know what edge you're exploiting, and the more you leave yourself to be up to be exploited or to make the wrong decision because you did A while the field did B, and then you have no edge, and maybe you ruined the edge that you had. And by playing every stack and player and construction at the rate at which those are actually optimal, basically makes you a like impenetrable wall of DFS lineups or whatever. So anyway, that's a good argument. I still am interested in exploiting the field on an ownership level at some level. Mostly because I'm going down the rabbit hole I said I wasn't going to go down. When you have only 150 lineups, you aren't going to be able to approach that perfect balance that well. You have to make decisions even in 150. You aren't truly, like, even if your portfolio exposures matched up perfectly to the rate at which different players were optimal, in your individual constructions and combinations of players, you're never actually going to be able to mimic a perfect balanced strategy for a given slate. So that's using ownership exploitation as a way to decide what those final lineups are that you're going to take with you into your contests, I think is a good way to answer a question that you have to answer anyway. You have to decide of the 10,000 lineup portfolio that you could potentially make that would be perfectly balanced, what are the 150 you're going to play? And using ownership exploitation as a way to make that decision, I think is a really good approach. And allows you to kind of have some of the best of both worlds. But it's interesting. And anyway, I'm making myself move on to answer some of these other questions here. So Jared asked, Dylan Brooks, 63% owned last night in a 2-game slate. Is it stupid to fully fade chalk like him versus just going underweight? Any advantage? Seems like I either like the player or I don't. Thanks. This is ultimately up to you. It's up to your personal risk tolerance. For me, how I would approach this is I would run my research build and see, you know, it would depend on how likely Brooks was to be in the optimal lineup, right? If he was 50% likely to be in the optimal lineup at 63% owned, right, he might be a good enough play that I want some exposure to him, or that it's too difficult to fade him completely. If he is a 20% chance to be in the optimal lineup and 63% owned, I may be more interested in completely fading him. That's kind of a personal risk tolerance question. On a 2-game slate, if you told me you wanted to fade anybody, I wouldn't talk you out of it. I think it's perfectly fine. You are playing in a more risky strategy, but there are so many players on the slate, or that's not what I meant to say. But there are so few players on the slate that ownership is so valuable that taking a stand like that can make some sense. And I have found that typically stepping through these 2 and 3 game slates in the playoffs so far, I have been making a big stand on one or two players like that in every slate so far. I haven't done any research tonight. I don't know who it will be tonight, but I have typically found that I have been doing something to that effect. And a lot of times it's like these guys. It's like the Paul Reeds of the world. Like if he's actually going to be 72% owned and he has 21 raw fantasy points of value, right? I don't care that he's a 5X value and he's the one of the only four players on the slate that has 5X value. It's typically this kind of player that I've been fading, is the chalky value. So I have no problem with that. Last note I'll make on this, again, it depends on how many lineups you're playing, right? It's a lot easier to say I'm skipping him in my 20 than if I'm skipping him in my 150, right? I would be more likely to be a little bit more moderate the more lineups I'm playing. The less lineups I'm playing, the more I'd want to take a stand. So Michael said, hey, Josh, sorry, I don't have my name up here. It is Jordan, actually. My display name doesn't show up when I have the small screen. So I'm Jordan anyway. Just getting into SaberSim this week, can you quickly explain how to enter into reserved contests on DK? A little unsure on if you mean how to reserve your contests or how to get your lineups into SaberSim. So I'll show you both, I guess. Easiest way to reserve on DK. So let's say I'm not entered into this free contest, Supercuts Fantasy Super Series. So that seems like a good one, right? You can enter here. Typically what we actually recommend people do is just fill up a lineup with a couple guys that like are probably playing, right? Like just do your best basically to make like a quick dummy, right? It doesn't have to be perfect, but if you can pick a few guys that are actually playing basketball, in the event that something goes horribly wrong with your schedule, you'll save yourself later. So something like this, right? So we have a lineup, okay? So we'll enter it. And then you can use this bulk enter button here to enter into everything else you want to play. So whatever else it is, I'm not going to enter into anything else because I'm entered for the slate already. I've got most of my lineups already in, or not my lineups, but I got my entries in, right? So, but you can use this bulk enter here. And, you know, if you wanted to play whatever else you wanted to play, you can add them all in here and then click submit, right? So from there, SaberSim makes, that is how you reserve your entries. SaberSim makes getting your lineups from SaberSim into these contests basically as easy as possible. So all you need to do is, let's go to DraftKings, not FanDuel, right? Is go to the entries tab, this button up here, entries. You're going to see this screen, upload your entries file. Literally just click this button, download template file from DraftKings. It will download a file to your computer and you can just drag and drop it. And then we'll see every entry I'm playing tonight is here. Just like in a second. So now all we need is lineups at this point. So what we'll do is I'll just quickly build some lineups here. Obviously, this would be whatever your actual lineup building process looked like, but I'm just building my 20 lineups. Go back to the entry editor here and now click fill contest with lineups. Find those lineups you just built. I'm going to use the rank fill method. If you are curious on what these different fill methods are, there's a tooltip that explains them in text. There's also a video, it's like a 4-minute video where I explain these in more detail here, what each of them do. But for this one, I'm just going to use the default one. And then once you have them in, download all entries, click that button, click download and open DraftKings, and it will give you a new entries file and take you to the page on DK where you upload it and you're done. Super easy, super quick. That is, I think, probably the best way to, one, reserve, but also fill once you're ready to do that. So hopefully that helps. There are a ton of tutorials all over this, tooltips and tutorials all over this page, that if you have questions like, what does this do? Or how do I do this? Everything should be explained with these little tooltips. So, okay. 12-pack said, you mentioned last week a bug affecting stack rules when combining at least with no more than. How will we know when that's fixed? Could we get a change log showing when issues are addressed? Yeah, the release notes channel in Slack is kind of functions as our change log. I would like for us to get a little bit more not, I don't even want to say consistent. I think having like a published changelog is a good idea. So I'll pass that along. I like the idea of that, and you could even see kind of different versions. It's a good idea. I will, as soon as I know it's fixed, I'll mention it here on stream, and maybe I'll post in the release notes that day when we post that, push that release. I do think having a published changelog that's more permanent is a great idea. So I'll pass that along. But Patrick said, last question, is it always better to build your lineup right until lock with the latest projections available? Or does that even matter if you build 1-2 hours prior to lock, barring injuries? I would say you should wait as close to lock as possible, capturing as much updated information as possible, and having as many confirmed lineups as possible up until the point where you can complete your process in time, right? There's nothing more negative EV than missing lock. So don't wait 5 minutes before lock to try to do everything at once and then miss lock just to say that you waited 5 minutes until lock. But no, I would say probably you shouldn't build your lineups 2 hours before lock. So we will put a green check mark next to the team abbreviation once we have starting lineups for that game and once we have run sims to update for those starting lineups. So I would say at least you should wait until there are starting lineups confirmed for every team playing in a game at lock. So for basketball tonight, that will basically just be the Sixers and the Heat lineup. For baseball, right? For baseball, it's a different story. Tonight, we might have every confirmed lineup before lock. You can see we already have confirmed lineups for half the teams. But, you know, I would probably, for me personally, I'm probably going to wait until I have starting lineups for at least all of these teams. This West Coast game might take a little bit longer to come out, but it's maybe we'll have these at lock too. But anyway, don't wait. Don't build 2 hours before lock and just set it and forget it. Also, don't miss lock because you were waiting so long, right? I would keep an eye on starting lineups and build once you have most of the starting lineups of all, at least all of the starting lineups of the teams playing at lock. So. Jacob said, yeah, I agree. With 150, you can't get super granular. You can really just optimize for stack exposure allocation for your portfolio. Sorry, didn't mean to derail you. No, don't apologize. I love this stuff. And I would go basically all afternoon going back and forth on this. I think this is one of the more interesting conversations going on in DFS at the moment. I think it is a really interesting one. I don't know. I mean, I think there's also, you know, another side of this, I think, is that there's an argument to be made that there is, I don't know how much I agree with this, but actually, let me put it this way. I have heard an argument made that there is no such thing as ownership exploitation, at least now. Not to say that there isn't any ownership exploitation in the game, period, or that there was at one point, but now the modern DFS game, that basically what this argument states is that if you think that the Blue Jays have a 12% chance to be the highest scoring stack and the field thinks it's a 15% or a 20%, it is not as if you are exploiting an edge by being under the field. You were just wrong. And that all edges in DFS are basically from a lineup construction standpoint and from a portfolio management standpoint. I don't totally agree with that because I think there are obvious situations where there is an ownership edge, right? And that, you know, late swap in an NBA on a 12-game main slate, that is an obvious situation where you can exploit the field and get 40% of a guy that the field only has 5% of. And if that exists, then there has to be smaller edges otherwise. But I think that is something I hear often as well, that like basically it is assuming that that the wisdom of the crowd is the end all be all in terms of contest adjusted optimal rates, and that your edge is in your constructions. Again, I don't know. I think it's all very interesting. But Jacob said, is there a Slack/Discord for SaberSim members? I built my own tools, but looking for a community to join of like-minded people. Yes, there is. There is a link to join in the description of every past Office Hours video. So if you go onto our YouTube channel and check on the... Or I'll just show you, right? Office Hours, So all these Office Hours videos are in this playlist. If you just click any one of these, pause it so you don't hear me twice, see this dumb spam comment that I'm going to have to delete as soon as we leave the stream. But in our description, this link will let you join. And when this video takes its journey from being a live stream that you're watching right now to being eventually a YouTube video just like this one, it too will have a link to join in the description. So. Uh, 12-Pack says, isn't the GTO argument that you build optimally and let the field make mistakes? Yes. Essentially. Yeah. But I guess what I was saying is that this is the conventional GTO argument. I think there's, and maybe I could be wrong here, but I think there's kind of a more modern argument here that I've at least, in DFS specifically, that I've encountered here, that it is not allow the field to make ownership mistakes. Basically assume that the field can't make ownership mistakes, and to intentionally match the field as optimal as possible, and to know that the field will make construction mistakes, and that like some of the last remaining edges in DFS are instead in your constructions. That for a variety of different ways, that could be correlation. But that could also be, you know, late swap flexibility, right? Something like that. So anyway, Scott says, Jordan, when you late swap on a large field GPP, does it only swap if it finds a better saver score, or if the variance is set to medium, will it just pick new lineups to create randomness? It will not. Not every lineup will get swapped. Well, technically, every lineup will get swapped. But if the best lineup possible is still the original lineup, we won't swap it for the sake of doing it. So when you actually run a late swap, you'll see your lineups over here. When you run a late swap build, instead of seeing lineups pool trash, this will say like lineups changed and unchanged. And especially as a slate goes on and there are less players available to be swapped at all, that you'll see that there are lineups in your pool that don't get changed. So if the best lineup is still the original lineup, we won't swap it. So Guy Will Gamble said, I missed some things, but to that point, if the field is completely irrational, then we don't need to worry about exploiting them. They will leave large enough gaps anyway. Yeah. It's strange because yes, that's true, right? Like it's weird. You get to weird conclusions, right? The more irrational the field is, the less we need to exploit them. Right? Because they will exploit themselves, right? That does make sense. Taken the other way, and maybe it's not true that, you know, one of my favorite fallacies, this is a Jordan Ellenberg thing, is not all slopes are lines, right? So, you know, if we say on one side that the more irrational the field is, the less we need to intentionally exploit them, that does not necessarily mean what I'm about to say is true, but I'm going to say it anyway. That would imply that the more rational the field is, the more exploitable, the more intentional we have to be about exploiting them. And I don't know, maybe that's true. I mean, I know, so, you know, I think one of the more interesting exploitation experiments is live finals, right? You have a generally sharp field of players playing in a way that at least is going to be pretty rational. And you have opportunities to exploit that field purely because they're predictable, right? Not necessarily because they're making more mistakes, but because they are predictable. And I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, I'm reading chat here now and kind of following along. And let's see, Jacob said that argument doesn't make sense. Ownership in the 555 is sharper than the 50 cent. How can Toronto at 12% in the 555 and 18% in the 50 cent both be correct regarding their top stack percentage? I agree with you. That argument doesn't make much sense. Well, okay. So what gets interesting here is, if you are assuming So ultimately, when you are calculating the optimal usage of a team, you are not calculating their optimal rate, right? You are calculating their percent chance of being in the winning lineup for a contest. So those top stack percent, in theory, isn't actually just an absolute number, or it shouldn't be. Toronto should have a unique top stack percent on, if you were being very specific about this, Toronto should have a top stack percent in the 555 and a top stack percent in the 50 cent that can be different because there are different lineups in those contests, and what it takes to win those different contests would be different. So that is actually a limitation of the research builds that I run on SaberSim. I assume that the percent chance of a player being in the optimal lineup approximates the percent chance of a player being in the winning lineup in any given contest, but that's not necessarily actually true, right? If the field decided to not play any Toronto stacks in some arbitrary contest, then apart from your own lineups, well, I don't even want to get in your own lineups, then by definition, Toronto has a 0% chance of being in the winning lineup in that contest. So in some ways, ownership is actually an input to the optimal, to the percent chance of winning. So I don't know. That's an interesting component there as well. And that's also, I think, why I think that that's why that lends some, I don't know. I think that lends some credence to the idea that the wisdom of the crowd is pretty right, or at least like more right. That like, I don't know, that if the field says Toronto should be rostered at 18% in the minimax and 12% at the 555, that's just correct. But yeah, I don't know. It is interesting. So, I mean, what is difficult like about these is that these quantifying the percent chance of a team actually having different outcomes is actually still very hard and has a lot of variance and a lot of unpredictability, period. Right? You can do things, I mean, you can use like coin flipped examples to demonstrate things like ownership matters in general, but I don't know. It's a market itself, right? And if your process was leading you to believe that Toronto should be rostered in 30% of lineups and the field, it has them in 12%, right? Even if it's the minimax, it doesn't even matter. Even if it's a contest that's perceived soft, right? Is it really fair to believe that you have an 18% ownership edge because of whatever model you're using than the field does? Like, is that actually a realistic exploitable edge that exists in MLB DFS in 2022? Does the field get stacks wrong by 18%? I don't know. I don't know how much I agree with that. Maybe they do, but I don't know. So, Guy Will Gamble says, wisdom of the crowd is greater than no wisdom at all. The key is identifying gaps in conventional wisdom to exploit. Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking, right? That's kind of what I'm talking about here too. Like, I just don't know. I don't know. I wonder how big those gaps actually are. So anyway, been a fun one here today. I think I'm gonna leave it there while my brain is kind of proceeding to start melt. Case in point, my brain start melt. I don't know. I love talking about this stuff. I think it's fun having a little bit of back and forth on this stream. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this one here today. We will be right back here again tomorrow, or I will be right back here again tomorrow. Same time, same place, 2 p.m. Eastern. So come join me then. Happy to follow up on any of these conversations or continue to talk about whatever else you guys want to talk about. Enjoy the baseball main slate. Enjoy the NBA 2 gamer here tonight. Wish you guys the best of luck on your slates. I guess last couple notes here before we wrap up, I'll give you three to walk away with. One, podcast version of the show is coming. It's very close. We should have that live this week. So for those of you that in particular just kind of like to listen and have the show on in the background, I know there's a lot of you guys out there. We should have a version of the show getting published this week that's a little bit more functional for that. If you guys are not already in that Slack community, I mentioned it a couple times here on stream today. Link to join in the description of this video. Once this is a video on YouTube and not a live stream, but it's also in the description of every past Office Hours video on our YouTube channel. So go get joined up into Slack. And the final note, if you watch this stream today and haven't already signed up with SaberSim, we have a free 7-day trial, sabersim.com. Come check us out. No strings attached. Come check out our tools, see what it's all about. If you don't like it, that's fine. Cancel before the 7 days. We won't ever charge you, but definitely recommend joining up and becoming a part of the community here. So anyway, back again here tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern. Good luck tonight and see you guys then. See ya.